We will today cover the second part of our study of chapter 31. Why so much attention given to chapter 31? Unplanned, I can assure you, but as I studied the chapter, I came to realize that this chapter marks a crucial point in the book of Job. It sums up all that he has tried to say in the first 30 chapters, because as we will read at the end of chapter 31, the sentence occurs, and so the words of Job are ended. So really, after the close of chapter 31, he is not going to speak again, not in a dialogue with the friends or with Elihu. He does speak briefly, very briefly, but it is in reply to God. So this is his closing testimony, what you might call his final defense. It's a make or break situation, and because of the importance of all the arguments, I unfortunately could not compress it into one lesson. So we are into the second part. The final part will cover the tail end of chapter 31 and then move on to the speeches of Elihu next Lord's Day, God willing. We had a point now where Job has categorized sins in 13 distinct categories, and he has enumerated these 13 categories in detail, and what is more important for us is that he has scrupulously tested himself against each of these categories to see whether he is guilty of any of those sins, whether he falls short according to these categories of sin. And in every case, having tested himself before he opened his mouth, he could confidently say, for this category of sin, I am innocent, I am free of it. Please understand that at no point are we to interpret this as implying that Job laid claim to being sinless. He never did that. He wouldn't have dreamed of doing it. But his point from the beginning has always been this: if ever I have caught myself in any sin, I have never delayed in repenting, in making the sacrificial offering, and in trying to put my life right and never repeating it again. So it is in that sense that he could say, I am free of these sins. And that same principle is a very practical principle that applies to believers through the ages. We can honestly say today, I am free of any of these sins, if we have consistently practiced the same methodology as Job. Daily self-examination, daily prayer, daily confession to God and repentance, and resolving, trying really hard never to repeat those sins or those errors again. We have completed the earlier categories of sins, and today we will look at verses 24 onwards. As we look at these categories of sin, we will find that there is an underlying sentiment which is very important for us to appreciate. It is one thing to categorize sins and to list them out. It's like being a moral bookkeeper. It's relatively easy to be a moral bookkeeper. But if that's all we do, it's really nothing more than an academic exercise. We have to go deeper, as Job did, and ask ourselves, what is the underlying sentiment? What's the point of examining myself against these categories of sin just to be able to say, thank God I'm free of this sin? So what if you're free of this sin? If you don't understand the underlying sentiment, then for sure you're either going to repeat that sin again, or you're going to fall into other and possibly greater sins. So you need to dig down as Job did, and come to the realization of what is really required of us in examining our daily lives against these 13 categories of sin. In other words, what is the true basis of wisdom? Because that is the one quality above all that we human beings need to live in a way pleasing to God, to live a life that is wise in the sight of God. And the moral insight displayed by Job in getting down to the underlying principle is so profound that it was not repeated again till 2000 years later, when Christ openly enunciated it in the Sermon on the Mount. And that principle is this: that if we truly can appreciate the majesty and holiness of God, then we will automatically desire to follow after righteousness throughout our life, in all areas of the life, and at the same time to turn away actively from even the mere appearance of sin. That attitude is what is summarized in the phrase, the fear of the Lord. So to put it compactly, we can say, as in the book of Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is truly the beginning of wisdom. And this is a phrase that is also repeated by Job in the closing verse of chapter 28. So now the next category of sin that Job is going to deal with is idolatry in any shape or form whatsoever, verses 24 through 28. If I have made gold my hope, or have said to the fine gold, thou art my confidence, if I rejoiced because my wealth was great and because mine hand had gotten much, if I beheld the sun when it shined, or the moon walking in darkness, and my heart hath been secretly enticed, or my mouth has kissed my hand. If he had done all these things, he says, verse 28, this also, all of these sins, above sins, were an iniquity to be punished by the judge being God. For I should have denied the God that is above. And here is the crux of it all. What makes idolatry so objectionable? There are many aspects of it that are repulsive and objectionable to any true believer, but the core of it lies in this. The reason why God will not tolerate any form of idolatry, even if it doesn't involve a physical idol, so long as you are technically guilty of idolatrous worship, it is repugnant to God. The reason is, by doing so, you have, as Job puts it in verse 28, you have effectively denied the God that is above. And in the Decalogue, if you remember, the first commandment is, thou shalt have no other gods before me. God will not tolerate anything else supplanting him in the affections of the human heart. So this is the real danger of idolatry, that it might displace God from the first place in the heart of man. But that said, there is a form of idolatry which may not appear such, but which is enormously attractive to human beings, and that is the acquisition of material wealth. Because wealth has this attraction to it. It brings along with it a lot of what we might call fringe benefits. Along with wealth, there is recognition, there is popularity, there is power, there is social status, and a host of other benefits. If you have visited any of the local banks towards the end of the month or in the first week of the following month, and you would find yourself somewhere stuck in a very long queue, and it may take you half an hour to 45 minutes to get to the counter. And then your eye would have noticed with some degree of anger or envy, there is another counter and another queue line which is practically empty except for maybe one or two persons. And there is a placard above it saying treasured client or preferred client. And you wonder why one dedicated staff is serving one customer while there are 50 people waiting to be served at the other counters. And then you begin to wonder, if I had enough to deposit, I won't be queuing up like this, I'll be in that queue. So here is a practical example to illustrate the fact that it is not just having the money itself, it is all the other fringe benefits that go about with it. If you were to walk into a bank and they know that you are what they call a high value or high net worth individual, you will be met and greeted at the door and accompanied to a special counter, a special table, even a special room. And it makes you feel good. So these are the fringe benefits that material wealth bring along with it. And there are a host of these benefits. Because of these fringe benefits, wealth, money, has a power of attractiveness that far exceeds just the item itself. And because of that, the love of money can easily displace the love of God from our hearts, and the pursuit of wealth can become to us a form of idolatry. And what Job says is, I may be wealthy, that's by the grace of God. I may be influential and powerful, that is a blessing of God. But I have never put any value on wealth. I have simply treated it as a resource. I'm given stewardship over it, and I'm required by God to use it well. And Job says, I have used it well. I've used my wealth to help many, many of people who are in need. I have not abused my wealth. So what he is saying is that he had experienced all of the privileges that go along with wealth, but free of the negative side of it. Unfortunately, his friend Eliphaz had mistakenly assumed that because of his wealth, Job had allowed mammon to supplant God in his heart. Which is why, if you turn back to chapter 22, you will find in his speech a subtle insinuation that Job had allowed mammon to supplant God in his heart. And this is an insinuation which is very damaging to the person, the personality of Job. And he takes it up and does not let it go. He cannot. If this kind of accusation is made against you, you can't just keep quiet. You like it or not, you have to address it. What is that insinuation that Eliphaz made against Job? Chapter 22, verses 24 and 25. Before we read this, word of caution, if you read it out of context as we are doing right now, the insinuation that Eliphaz is making will not come out clearly. But when you read it in context and when you dissect the words in those two phrases, in those two verses, then it will come out. What did Eliphaz have to say? In verses 24 and 25, he tells Job, then shall thou lay up gold as dust, and the gold of Ophir as the stones of the brook. Yea, the Almighty shall be thy defense, and thou shalt have plenty of silver. Silver being used as a metaphor for strength. Now to appreciate where this hidden insinuation lies, let's pick these two verses apart. Verse 24 suggests to Job, thou shalt lay up gold as dust and the gold of Ophir, which is the very high grade gold, as the stones of the brook. It suggests to Job he would have so much gold in his hands, that is, assuming he had fulfilled certain conditions, he would have so much gold in his hands that he would treat it as the dust of the ground, or as the pebbles that we picked up, that we pick up from the bed of the river. I remember years ago a colleague of mine at the workplace who was known as the overtime king. He made so much money on overtime that one day I heard him boasting. Somebody asked him, have you paid your income tax? And he declared with his arms thrown apart, I have paid them $X thousand. And the next question was, did you arrange with income tax to pay by installment? And he snorted loudly and says, why should I pay by installment? I paid them cash over the counter. He had so much money in his hands that he could just throw the notes across the counter. So Eliphaz is saying, friend Job, if you fulfill certain conditions which are in the earlier part of chapter 22, you will have that much gold that you can treat it like dust. That doesn't appear to be critical of Job, but the unspoken criticism of Eliphaz is that you, Job, have allowed the pursuit of wealth to displace God from your heart. This is an insinuation that we know and Job knew to be completely false. But Job was very hurt by this and he had to address it, which we will come to in a minute. And Eliphaz goes on in verse 25 to say, the Almighty shall be thy defense. The Hebrew word betza, which the KJV has translated defense, can also mean gold in the raw state, that is, gold as dug out from the earth before it is refined. So again, that reinforces Eliphaz's insinuation that his friend Job had allowed the love of money to take first place in his heart. Job obviously got the point. We may not, because it's a very subtle insinuation. And he immediately addressed it in chapter 31. He issues an emphatic, a spirited denial that he had ever in his life put wealth above God. Now we have to turn forward to chapter 31 and verse 24. If I have made gold my hope, or have said to the fine gold, thou art my confidence. We again have to pick this apart. First, you notice the two halves of this verse. It will be very clear to us by now that we have staring in our face a beautiful example of what kind of parallelism would this be. Remember, there are three basic types: synonymous, synthetic, and antithetic. There's actually a fourth type which we won't go into. Three basic types. This one would be S, S, or A. It would be the first S, synonymous, because it basically repeats the same idea in a different way. Gold, my hope; fine gold, my confidence. So the gold in the first half refers to the refined metal, from the Hebrew root word, that which shimmers, gleams. So that gold is negatively associated with hope. And in the second half, the fine gold, referring to that which is dug out of the earth, is negatively associated with my confidence. And then verse 25 is also within that verse a synonymous parallelism. Because my wealth was great and because my hand had gotten much. But verse 25 is in relation to verse 24 is synthetically parallel, meaning to say it carries on the idea of verse 24 and adds to it. If I rejoice because my wealth was great and because my hand had gotten much. So these two verses constitute Job's rebuttal, because what appears in these two verses is the if condition. So you might say, where is the then condition, the penalty? That comes in verse 28. So we read verses 24 and 25 with a view to verse 28, and it would appear in this way. Job says, if I have ever made gold my hope, my confidence, or if ever I rejoice simply because I had so much money and I prided myself on my cleverness, then this would be a sin that would be punished severely by God, because I would then have denied God and put wealth first place in my heart. Then we come to the next couplet, verses 26 and 27. It's still part of Job declaring that he has been free of idolatry. If I beheld the sun when it shined, or the moon walking in brightness, and my heart hath been secretly enticed, or my mouth hath kissed my hand. Very interesting couplet of verses. Please note in verse 26 the word sun. It's a very interesting word. The Hebrew root is or, which is written for you on the board. And the reason it is interesting is the association that goes along with it. But first, the technical details. For those of you who love numbers, here are some numbers for you. In the Old Testament, the KJV renders this Hebrew root word or as light on 114 occasions and as sun only once. So we really wonder why the translators chose sun in this particular verse. And we do not know why, because the notes of the translators have not survived. But they must have had a very good reason in this context for so doing. However, for us the interest is the association with something else. Sun is associated with light, and that fits in with the Hebrew root word or. Why is light so interesting? Because if you look at the history of early pre-Abrahamic civilization, that is to say the civilizations of Job's time and even earlier, you will find that idolatry was the norm. And one of the earliest forms of idolatry involved the worship of light, and in particular those heavenly bodies that manifested light, chiefly the sun, the moon and the stars. Not the planets so much, the sun and the moon and the stars, because they obviously gave out, so to speak, light. Of course, we know that today the moon doesn't give out light, but to all intents and purposes, it is radiant. And why did early civilizations, granted they were degenerating spiritually from the fall of Adam and the dispersal of the races, after the Tower of Babel, there was a continual and unstoppable spiritual degeneration which continues and will continue until Christ returns. But what drove early civilizations to worship light. The motivation behind all forms of idolatry, particularly the early forms of idolatry, the motivation is very simple. Gratitude for those agents or entities that brought them discernible benefits in their daily life. Without the light from the sun, life on earth would not be possible. Early men knew this perfectly well. There would be no crops, no agriculture. Even if you could survive in the darkness, there would be no food that you could grow, because plant life needs light. Agriculture would be impossible. And if you look at the food chain, animals are ultimately dependent on plant life, just as human beings are dependent on animals and plants. So really, life would not be possible without the light from the sun. So, and in the night, those who were traveling depended on the light from the moon and the light from the stars, distant though they are, for finding their way about. Particularly sailors, they needed it for dead reckoning. Therefore, it is understandable that early civilizations should look to these bodies in the heavens that gave out or reflected light with gratitude, because to them it was these entities that made normal life possible. And how did the depraved heart of early man express this gratitude? Instead of turning to the one living and true God, who is the creator and the upholder of all of these things, they were led in their depraved state to worship these entities, the sun, the moon and the stars, as if they are the ones conferring all these benefits upon mankind. And that is how the worship of light, which materialized or manifested itself in the form of sun worship, moon worship, came about. What about the moon walking in brightness? This, of course, is a very beautiful and poetic metaphor. It can refer either to the movement of the moon across the sky at night, from sunset to sunrise, or it could refer to the changing phases of the moon: crescent moon, half moon, the three-quarter moon, the full moon, the gibbous moon, and then it declines, and then there is darkness, and then back again to the crescent moon. So it could refer to that cycle also. Bear in mind that the moon was worshipped in ancient civilizations along with the sun, and there was one day of the week set aside specially for the worship of the moon. And guess which day that was? The moon day is our Monday. So Monday, according to ancient civilization, the practice of ancient civilization, tomorrow would be your day of worshipping the moon. Not that I am encouraging you to do that. And what about verse 27? And my heart hath been secretly enticed, or my mouth hath kissed my hand. This apparently refers to the ancient practice of these idolaters of blowing a kiss. You know the gesture? Blowing a kiss to the heavenly bodies. So it surprised me to learn that this supposedly innocent gesture has pagan overtones to it. So my advice to young lovers is, perhaps you should refrain from any of these gestures when you separate. Confine your parting gesture to a handshake. Thus far, I have not found any pagan association with a handshake. Or even safer is the open palm. This is supposed to be the universal symbol of goodwill. Nothing I can find pagan about it. But certainly this, we now know, has pagan origins. So be careful. These are the, to us, pathetic, but to ancient men it was a deadly serious matter. Being depraved and not knowing the true, one true living God, the religious instinct in man drove him to worship. And because he did not know the one true and living God, that religious instinct drove man to worship any agent that he deemed could bring him daily benefit, besides the sun, moon and the stars, the Nile in Egypt, which brought, the flooding of the Nile brought fertility to the land. So whatever object or agent in nature brought benefit became in ancient civilization an object of worship. And Job says, I have not indulged in any form of idolatry, any shape or form. If I did so, I would have been severely punished, because idolatry, what is really objectionable to it, is it entails a denial of the one living and true God. Bear in mind that Job lived in at a time possibly even predating Abraham, a time in which his community probably were idolaters, and he was certainly surrounded by nations that in the Near East that were definitely, we know from archaeological records, were idolatrous nations. And yet in the midst of all this idolatry, we find one individual and his family holding on to a core of faith in the one living and true God. Job was not the only such individual. There definitely would have been others. I mean, we know in even in before the time of Job, there was Enoch, that who had this testimony that he walked with God and God took him and he was not, and that is well before the time of Job. So there were here and there interspersed amidst the depraved nations of the world after the Tower of Babel, individuals and even small communities, what we call the remnant, that remained faithful to the one living and true God. And this feature has been true of believers right down to our very day. Particularly as we live in the last of the last days, we will find the falling away of the faith accelerating and the community of believers, true believers, shrinking. The next category of sins that Job wants to deal with is in verses 29 and 30, harboring a vengeful attitude towards opponents or enemies. It is equivalent to saying, vengeance is mine and mine alone. I will repay. Not God will repay, I will repay. That is the attitude described in these two verses, verses 29 and 30. If I rejoiced at the destruction of him that hated me, or lifted up myself, gloated over, when evil found him. Neither have I suffered my mouth to sin by wishing a curse to his soul. To say in your heart, when your enemy suffers, serves him right that he lost his job. That is equivalent to uttering a curse against that person. The question Job raises is, are we ever justified, even if we have been maligned by that person, when that person suffers ill to the extent of perhaps losing his job, are we ever justified in saying, even inwardly, serves him right? Job says, as far as he is concerned, that would have amounted to sinning with his mouth, sinning in his heart. And these two verses are part of a very lengthy oath of innocence that makes up the bulk of chapter 31. And verses 29 and 30 may not overtly carry the if-then structure of the oath, but it is implied. if I am guilty of these things, then let me be punished. It's implied. You must appreciate that the time in which Job lived, the attitude was not that of forbearing one another. The attitude was, can be described in this way. Part A, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And the complement to that, part B, you scratch my back, I will scratch yours. The two go together. And this was typical of the time in which Job lived. And guess what? 5,000 years later, we are living in the same kind of environment. You scratch my back, I will scratch yours. You support me, I will support you. You hurt me, I will hurt you back. Maybe even more, so that you will be discouraged from trying it again. So, after 5,000 years of progress, we have regressed back to that kind of primitive mentality. So much for progress. Job, as an individual, was way ahead of his time, because he says he never espoused this policy of the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. He says that friend or foe, whoever suffered, whoever lifted up his hand against him or his family, he never went out of his way to hurt that person. I mean, he didn't go out of the way to befriend that person, because obviously that person had ill will towards him. But he kept his distance, but he never wished ill, nor did he glory if that person were to suffer in life. This attitude of Job is unique, because although he comes so early in the spiritual history of mankind, he displays the fruit of what might be called religion pure and undefiled. The type of religion that was clearly enunciated 2,000 years after his time by Jesus Christ. Sermon on the Mount, and the verses that are relevant to us in this discussion of Job are the following. Matthew chapter 5, reading from verses 43 through 45. Christ says, "Ye have heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and the unjust." To understand what Christ is trying to say, we have to discern that there are two streams of love mentioned here, both flowing from the same wellspring, the wellspring of a general goodwill towards all men. From that wellspring, there are two distinct streams, although both are called love. And to understand what Christ means and how we are to apply it, we have to be aware that there are these two distinct streams, both called love, flowing out of the same general sense of goodwill towards men. The first stream entails a warm approval of both the person and his actions, and for want of a better term, call this phileo. The other entertains goodwill towards the person, even though disapproving of his actions. So what Christ is referring to when he says, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, is not the first kind of love, because a person who does these things to you without justification, you cannot obviously approve of his actions, but you can still be forbearing and show mercy towards that person. And that goes with the second stream of love, which is maybe called, to distinguish it from the first, benevolence. So really, in Christ, in this portion of the Sermon on the Mount, Christ is referring to two streams of love. The phileo, what I call phileo, and I'm taking some liberty here because I couldn't find a better word for it, involves approving, liking both the person and the actions. And the second one, the benevolence, that is what Christ says we are to exhibit towards those who set themselves up as our enemies for no good reason at all. It is relatively easy to show love when you approve of the person and the action. So the phileo is relatively easy to follow, to imitate. But benevolence is that grace which is perhaps, in practical terms, the most difficult of all the Christian graces to practice. What Job is saying is that in the course of his life, he has consistently exhibited both these streams of love, the phileo and the benevolence towards all men. In particular, he has never gone out of his way to hurt, to take revenge upon, or even to gloat over his enemies. So again, you notice his methodology. Identify the sins 1 through 13, they are categories of sins. Test himself, and then when he's sure that he is free of it, declare, as he's doing now, I am innocent of these sins. Next category of sin, verse 31, withholding goodwill. If the men of my tabernacle said not, oh, that we had of his flesh, we cannot be satisfied. Read it out of context, and it might appear to be promoting cannibalism. But I can assure you, it's got nothing to do with that. It has to do with goodwill, hospitality, and the related sentiments. The men of my tabernacle refers either to those who dwelt with Job, his family, his servants, his dependents, or else were people who were closely associated with Job and who therefore would know him inside out. And what Job is saying is this: these persons who know me well can and will so testify that if I have ever had any visitor, he never went away without being thoroughly fed and thoroughly rested, hospitably entertained, in other words. I have never, in that sense, says Job, withheld goodwill. The next category of sin, withholding hospitality. Now, verse 32, hospitality might not be a big deal in the times in which we live, but in ancient times, and certainly the time of Job, it was a very important consideration. Anyone traveling and finding himself in a strange city at sunset would not dare to go further because traveling by night was deemed too dangerous. So he would be forced to take refuge in whichever city, town, or village he came across in the course of his journey before sunset, if at all possible. The question is, he's a stranger, and to the credit of ancient society, provision was made for such people. They were not turned out of the city. This would have been a problem in the case of fortified cities, because then the traveler would have to pitch tent outside the city and be exposed to the dangers of highway robbers and animals. So these strangers, not knowing anyone, the practice was either they were directed to what is called the Central Plaza, not a shopping mall. It is a place specially provided for such travelers where they could take refuge for the night, or else one of the citizens who felt so bound, duty bound, would invite the stranger to his house, give him food and shelter for the night, and send him on his way. So hospitality was a big thing in ancient cultures, and it would have been a sin to withhold hospitality from a stranger. What Job is saying is in verse 32, the stranger did not lodge in the street, even though he had the central plaza to which he could go. But if I ever came to know of a stranger who had come into my city, I would, he says, open my doors to the traveler. Meaning to say, the traveler would have been greeted warmly by Job, invited to his home, fed sumptuously, and given shelter for the night, and then sent on his way thereafter. To prove to you that this was indeed a practice in ancient times, even after the time of Job, I would direct your attention to the case of Lot. It's a very interesting, for our purposes anyway, a very interesting sociological study, the practice of Lot compared with the practice of Job, roughly the same period of time. If you turn to the 19th chapter of Genesis and look at verses 1 and 2, Genesis 19, 1 and 2, and there came two angels to Sodom at even. Bear in mind that to Lot at the time, they weren't angels. He didn't know them or didn't recognize. They didn't come to him with wings on their back. They came to him as apparently human beings, travelers passing through the city, and Lot took them to be strangers on a journey. And it was nightfall and they couldn't go on. They had to take shelter in his city. Two angels, two strangers came to Sodom at even. And Lot, as was his custom, sat in the gate of Sodom. And Lot, seeing them, rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. Apparently, the common practice in greeting strangers. Verse 2, chapter 19 of Genesis. And he, Lot, said, "Behold now, my lord, turn in, I pray you, into your servant's house, and tarry all night, and wash your feet, and ye shall rise up early and go on your ways." And they said, the stranger said, "Nay, but we will abide in the street all night." This must not be understood as literally sleeping on the roadside at night, but rather, remember the central plaza? That what they said is, "No, we will not trouble you, we will not burden you, you don't know us. We will go to the central plaza and take refuge there for the night." But Lot said, "No." Verse 3, and he, Lot, pressed upon them, the stranger, greatly persuading them. And they turned in unto him and entered into his house. And he, that is Lot, made them a feast and did bake unleavened bread, and they did eat. I recall many years ago, for some strange reason, becoming very hungry at 10 p.m. And since I could get no food in my own house, I drove to my brother's house thinking that I would be hospitably received, and asked for steak at 10 p.m. And unfortunately, my sister-in-law, well, she didn't drive me out, but it made it clear that hospitality would not be extended to me, not if it entailed making steak at 10 p.m. at night. I was much younger and much more foolish. I am not inclined to do that. But had I lived in the time of Lot or Job, I would have had my feet washed, I would have been fed sumptuously with steak, and I would have had the best and softest bed in the house to sleep in. But we are not living in that time. The third category, the next category of sin, and we need to stop with this, is in verse 33. Hypocrisy, concealment of sin. Verse 33. If I covered my... Remember, always in all of these verses there is an if-then structure, even though the then clause may not explicitly appear, as in this case, verse 33. If I covered my transgressions as Adam, very interesting word, by hiding my iniquity in my bosom. Now, what exactly is this Adam? The Hebrew root word is Adam. Now, some commentators and translators, including, surprisingly, Luther in his German translation, took that Hebrew word Adam in this context, Job 31:33, to mean man in general and not Adam, a particular human being. Other translations and other commentators, for example, the Dutch Bible of 1637, which to the Dutch people is the equivalent of the Authorized Version in English, they take it to be literally Adam, as did the translators of the Authorized Version. The question is it Adam, man in general, or Adam, the first man? We can discern which of it by using a bit of CSI technique. We ask ourselves, what was Lot trying to do? He was trying to declare or prove his freedom from this particular sin, hypocrisy, that is the concealment of sin. Now, human beings, more often than not, yes, they do try to cover up their sin, but that is not invariably the case. Surprisingly, there are individual human beings who are honest. If they make a mistake or if they sin, they do admit it openly. So there are quite a surprising number of people who are honest. So we cannot say that it is the rule that human beings, whenever they sin, will cover up their sin. That being the case, if the Hebrew Adam is taken to be man in general, if I covered my transgressions as human beings are accustomed to do, then the impact which Job was trying to make is actually weakened. On the other hand, if we take the Hebrew word Adam to refer to Adam, the first man, what would the difference be? Because Adam, the first man, when he sinned, the immediate reaction of Adam was concealment of that sin, not from any other human being, because apart from Eve, there were no other human beings in existence, but concealment from God. And that ultimately is what makes it a sin, where you conceal it, not so much from your fellow human beings, but you attempt to conceal it from God. That is the sting of it. You're trying to hide this from God. You're trying to make a fool of God, thinking that God can be deluded into thinking that you are free of this sin. And this was Job's objective. I have not been guilty of concealing any sin from God. We read that Job had daily examined himself, and periodically he offered up sin offerings. All of this illustrates the lifestyle of a person who, because he examined himself honestly, whenever and wherever he found sins in his life, he would confess it. Even though it may be shameful, he would be open and above board where God is concerned. Therefore, to bring that impact across, that he's free of this sin of concealment, I would argue that the Hebrew root word Adam does not refer to man in general, as some have taken it to be, but to Adam, the first man in particular. And this concealment of sin from God is fundamentally what human beings have tried to do down the ages. And Job says unequivocally, I have never attempted to hide any sin either from God or from my fellow men. So bear with me, next Lord's Day, God willing, we will finish the last two categories of sin, verses 34 and then on 38 to 39. And verse 40 is the closing verse of the chapter, and we will then hopefully begin on the speeches of Elihu.